This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 7 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, this episode, we're going to be discussing a spacecraft called Chandra, which has far exceeded both its planned mission duration and the expectations that were held for its revelations. But first, I've got an update. Steve, this is about the NASA program called Artemis, which is the name of the 21st century version of the old Apollo program. In other words, it's about returning humans to the lunar surface. Now, things are going slowly, and the boobirds out there are saying that it won't be long before the program itself is on life support. So previously, we'd mentioned this, well, it's exciting news that Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen was going to be one of the four crew members on Artemis II. And at the time of that announcement, we thought it was going to be happening with a launch this year or later this year. But well, it's been delayed as Artemis II systems continue to be tested. So what's new? Not much. Now, I could mention that the big news splash about there about this mission has been the new spacesuits that are going to be used. And that's because the news was all about the fashion giant Prada. But despite the science involved in any kind of new spacesuit, the headlines were all about fashion and space. And I don't know about you, Steve, but when people complain about the money wasted on space exploration, I often find myself thinking about the money wasted on new fashion trends. But no, there's not much real news about the progress of the mission itself, and that is the problem. So NASA has postponed the Artemis II date until no earlier than September of 2025. And they've stopped even talking about a fixed date for Artemis III. Now, one of the problems that cropped up way back in 2022 was the performance of the heat shield on board the Orion crew cabin, and that was during an unmanned flight. And it seems that that problem has not yet been resolved, even though it's been a couple of years. Now, there's a growing list of other key elements of the program that seem to be stuck in, I don't know, reverse? So, Steve, here's the irony. It looks like we're about to be reliving the race to the moon from the 1960s. And why is that? Well, that's because there is growing evidence that the Chinese space program is going to be capable of landing a person on the moon before the end of the decade.
And mine starts today with a brief nod to the spate of recent Aurora Borealis viewings in our relatively southern latitudes, and hurry for that. As previously mentioned, our sun is approaching its 11-year solar maximum of sunspots. But of course, we won't know when that maximum has occurred until it wanes, and then data analysis will determine when it peaked. For reference purposes, the last solar maximum occurred in April 2014, some 10 years ago.
Okay, Steve, that's a tip of the hat. What about today's update?
Well, today I want to talk about the U.S. Space Force's X-37B space plane, which we previously mentioned on Space Talks. The Space Force describes this vehicle as a reusable, uncrewed spacecraft which strengthens the United States' future in space by conducting technological experiments that expedite the development of next-generation capabilities.
Well, that's just a descriptor that sounds a lot like a politician's political platform consisting of a lot of words but little detail. And as we know, the devil is in the detail. So, what do we actually know about this highly secret program?
Well, there are two X-37Bs, and they have conducted six previous missions. Now, one of the interesting things about this mission is the Chinese launched their own version of a reusable space plane, which they call Shenlong, 2 weeks prior to the X-37B launch on December 14, 2023, which leads one to wonder about that coincidental timing. Did the American X-37B launch to spy upon Shenlong, which, by the way, means God Dragon, or was it the other way around for them to spy on the X-37B, since its launch window was widely known? Time will no doubt tell. Now, what we do know about China's Shenlong craft is that this third mission landed in September of this year after spending 267 days in space.
We should mention, Steve, that both the Chinese and American spacecraft look very similar to the old space shuttles, and it would seem there may be some other similarities in the two programs. However, they do differ in the mission duration. The American missions have been incrementally longer and longer. The first mission lasted 224 days, with durations extending to 468 days, 674 days, 717 days, 779, and the record-breaking 908 days in space. These gradually extended missions undoubtedly have a purpose, and as you say, time will no doubt tell.
And there are a couple of interesting things we do know about this current mission. While the previous six flights were in low Earth orbit, about 320 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, this one is highly elliptical, going from a low perihelion of 323 kilometers to an astoundingly high aphelion of 38,838 kilometers. And we also know it's been conducting radiation effect experiments and testing, quote, space domain awareness technologies.
Space domain awareness sounds like spin talk for spying on other nations' spy satellites, don't it? Well, I suspect that you're saving the best for last, Steve. So what does this orbiter have up its sleeve?
The U.S. Space Force has announced the orbiter is about to begin a series of novel aero-braking maneuvers to utilize drag from Earth's upper atmosphere. And this will help lower its current highly elliptical orbit while using a minimum amount of fuel. And once in a lower and more circular orbit, the space plane will then jettison its service module components, which means those components will rapidly burn up while descending through the upper atmosphere, mitigating space debris. And space debris is commonly referred to as space junk. And once those maneuvers are complete, the orbiter will continue its test and experimental objectives. But does that mean it will boost its orbit, remaining in space for a long period of time doing whatever it is it does? Who knows? But perhaps you heard it first here on Space Talks.
Okay, so that pretty well covers today's updates. Let's move on and tackle the main topic today, the Chandra device.
Well, you know, Tim, the last couple of episodes, we focused upon the Dominion Astronomical Observatory based in Victoria, BC. And today, we're going to have a look at another observatory, but it's quite unlike the DAO. As a matter of fact, until researching this topic, I wasn't aware of today's subject was classified as an observatory. But before we delve into what the Chandra is, we should talk about who it's named after.
I've sometimes heard the astrophysical term the Chandra limit, which is the maximum mass of a stable white dwarf star, and that's 1.44 solar masses. And using our sun as a reference mass of 1, that means that a star can get to be a bit more massive and still have a normal lifetime and death, if you will. However, larger than 1.44 solar masses, a star will eventually become a supernova in its end stages. But how does this particular Chandra term relate to today's topic, Steve?
Chandra, which incidentally means moon or luminous in Sanskrit, is the shortened surname for Subramanian Chandrasekhar, who is widely regarded as one of the foremost astrophysicists of the 20th century. Now, Chandra was a popular teacher who guided over 50 students to their PhDs, published 10 books covering different astronomical topics, and for 19 years served as editor of the Astrophysical Journal. In 1983, Chandra was awarded the Nobel Prize for his theoretical studies of the physical processes important to the structure and evolution of stars. And of course, it was he who determined mathematically the end states of stars which are more massive than our sun.
A very impressive character, this one. And since we started the show, I've come to appreciate some of the incredible achievements that these researchers in astronomy have achieved over the years. And in this case, Chandra's contributions, they've been acknowledged by lots of people, including Martin Rees, Great Britain's Astronomer Royal. And he said, "Chandra probably thought longer and deeper about our universe than anyone since Einstein." And that's, of course, high praise.
So we know who the Chandra Observatory was named after, but what it is remains the question. So here we go. Back in 1979, NASA proposed the concept of a great observatory program in a report entitled, quote, A Strategy for Space Astronomy and Astrophysics for the 1980s. NASA's Great Observatories program used four separate space-based astronomical satellites launched between 1990 and 2003, each designed to cover a different part of the spectrum in ways which terrestrial systems couldn't.
Well, we know that ground-based telescopes, such as the DAO in Victoria, gather light wavelengths or optics, and the CHIME apparatus in Penticton monitors radio waves. So, how does NASA's Great Observatories, space-based satellites, how are they different?
Well, since the Earth's atmosphere prevents X-rays, gamma rays, and far infrared radiation from reaching the ground, the four Great Observatories in space are able to examine those heretofore unattainable gamma rays and X-rays, in addition to ultraviolet, infrared, and visible light wavelengths.
Okay. Now, almost everyone has heard of the Hubble Space Telescope, but few realize it was the first of the four great observatories, and it observes near ultraviolet in addition to visible light. Of course, it was launched in 1990, and it does still remain in service, continuing to provide invaluable astronomical observations. Among its primary mission targets was to measure distances to Cepheid variable stars more accurately than ever before, and thus constrain the value of the Hubble constant. And that, of course, is the measure of the rate at which the universe is expanding.
The second great observatory was the $600 million Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, launched in 1991. Its primary purpose was to examine gamma rays and hard X-rays, and it exceeded its mission by 4 years and completely changed ideas on the most important unsolved puzzles in astrophysics. But one of its three gyroscopes failed, and it had to be safely deorbited rather than run the risk of continually operating should another gyroscope fail, which would lead to the potential of an unplanned deorbit over a populated area. The Compton Observatory was named after Arthur Compton, who received his Nobel Prize for work involved with gamma ray physics. Some accomplishments of this space-based observatory were to categorize and characterize four pulsars and to map an entire sky of gamma rays. It definitively showed that the majority of gamma ray bursts originate in distant galaxies and not in our own Milky Way, and therefore must have enormous energy since it could be seen from such tremendous distances.
The third great observatory is the Spitzer Space Telescope, and that was launched in 2003 with a design to observe the infrared spectrum. Now, this space-based telescope is named in honor of astronomer Lyman Spitzer, who had promoted the concept of space telescopes, and in 1946 he wrote a report for RAND Corporation describing the advantages of an orbiting space telescope observatory, which wouldn't have any viewing interference from, well, our atmosphere. Interestingly, his efforts led to the construction and launch of the Hubble Space Telescope.
And you've hit upon a couple of interesting points here, Tim. First, a little digging uncovers that RAND is an acronym for Research and Development, which was initially created as an intellectual think tank for the military. And secondly, the irony of Spitzer's efforts in creating a space telescope named for someone else. However, as you've noted, he did later get a space telescope named after him. Spitzer's mission was to last 2.5 years in space, with a pre-launch expectation that the mission could possibly be extended to 5 more years until its onboard liquid helium supply was exhausted, which indeed was the case. Launched in 2003, the Spitzer Space Telescope's helium lasted 6 years until 2009, and with some mission reconfiguration, the telescope remained partially functional until 2020.
The Spitzer Space Telescope was designed to detect the infrared or heat portion of the spectrum, so therefore it was necessary to reduce onboard ambient heat as much as possible. And this was accomplished in three ways. We've got to cool this thing down. The first way involved the use of liquid helium, which was used to cool the 85-centimeter primary mirror to a chilling 5.5 Kelvin, which equates to minus 268 degrees Celsius.
And we just might want to bring listeners up to speed on that Kelvin temperature scale, Tim. We're all familiar with the Fahrenheit and Celsius temperature scales, but scientists almost universally use the Celsius scale for small things, but for really, really cold experiments, they use the Kelvin scale. Now, it's named after Lord Kelvin, and this scale starts at absolute zero, the coldest possible temperature where atoms cease to move. In contrast, the Celsius scale considers zero to be where water freezes. Absolute zero on the Celsius scale is minus 278 degrees, so the Spitzer telescope was amazing in reducing its internal temperatures to almost that, minus 268 degrees Celsius.
You remember those Kelvinator refrigerators, Steve? They had that name because the company professed that they cooled food to a really cool temperature. But no, back to the spacecraft we're talking about. The second method used on the Spitzer was the creation of a sun shield to protect the rest of the spacecraft from the sun's heat. The main body of the spacecraft was thermally isolated from the telescope itself, and the far side of the spacecraft was painted black to enhance passive radiation of heat.
And finally, Spitzer was placed in an Earth-trailing orbit. Now, this was a new-to-me concept prior to researching for this episode. An Earth-trailing orbit is such that the telescope will gradually fall behind the Earth while still orbiting at a distance. It's sort of like a slow walker trailing a fast walker, getting further and further behind, but following the same path. This slow dog following his master orbit was to drastically reduce the heat load left behind by the warm Earth. Yes, we know that the sun radiates heat, but often forget that Earth too radiates a lot of heat, and therefore it leaves a heat trail in space.
So, clearly, the Spitzer Observatory is all about being chill. And in 2005, it became one of the first telescopes to directly capture light from a particular class of exoplanet called hot Jupiters. Then, in April 2005, observations were of a binary star in the Taurus constellation, and that led to new understandings of how our planets were formed. After about 400 hours of observations, it was deduced that our Milky Way galaxy isn't the perfect spiral as depicted countlessly in film and books. Nope, it has a substantial bar structure through the middle from which the spiral arms radiate. This means that our Milky Way is now classified as a barred spiral galaxy and doesn't resemble the Andromeda galaxy, which we've all seen countless times, even though we didn't know that at the time.
And so this begs the question of how do we know what our galaxy looks like, because we've never been, and never will, get to the outer edge and look back. It's sort of like being blindfolded and taken inside a windowless room in a building you've never before seen. And when the blindfold is removed, you're given a piece of paper and a pencil and asked to sketch the outside shape of the building and include some doors and windows. It's an impossibility. Is it a one-story or multiple-story building? Is it rectangular, square, or perhaps even oval in shape? You assume there are windows and doors, but have no idea as to their number or placement. You need additional information, just as astronomers wanted additional information about what our galaxy looked like. Now, I really think we're at the point where we finally talk about the fourth of the great observatories, the Chandra X-ray Observatory.
Well, we took some time in this episode to arrive at our focus today, and that's our bad pun for the week. I think our chronological approach lends to a better overall understanding, though, of the how and why of Chandra. And as we often do on Space Talks, let's take a very quick review of the electromagnetic spectrum to better understand its mission. First of all, radio waves have very long wavelengths. For example, CKVS broadcasts at 93.7 on the FM band. But what does that really mean? Well, to most, it's just a number. It's when you dial up when you want to listen to the station. The number 93.7 is an abbreviation, though, for 93,700,000. And imagine having to write that down on your radio dial. But for the sake of brevity, instead, 93.7 million gets shifted around with decimals to 93.7, plus the suffix of megahertz. But whatever does that huge number represent, you may well ask? It stands for the number of cycles per second, and using our good new artificial intelligence friend, this number of 93.7 megahertz, it equates to a wavelength of 3.2 meters. So if you could see a radio wave from CKVS, It would be about the width of a small bedroom. Imagine that.
And when radio wavelengths are shortened from meters long to mere centimeters long, you get microwave. And your typical microwave oven produces wavelengths of energy of about 12 centimeters long, but they're still too long to be visible. And by the way, we should mention that as wavelengths become shorter, their intensity increases, which is not a moot point, as we'll see. Shorten wavelengths further, and microwaves sort of magically become infrared or heat waves, with wavelengths between 1 millimeter and 700 nanometers. And though this is really short, they're still too long to be seen. Shorten infrared waves, and suddenly we see red. And then shorten further, we see the colors of orange, yellow, green, blue, and finally violet. Make visible wavelengths shorter still, and they suddenly again become invisible ultraviolet or tanning wavelengths. Shorten those wavelengths even more, and they become X-rays, which, as we know, are quite energetic, forcing us to limit our exposure to them.
And finally, if X-ray wavelengths are shortened, they become extremely intense gamma ray waves. And what appeal do they have to astronomers? Well, gamma rays have the smallest wavelengths and the most energy of any wave in the electromagnetic spectrum. And they're produced by the hottest and most energetic objects in the universe. So we're talking about such esoteric terms as neutron stars, pulsars, blazars, magnetars, supernova explosions, and regions around black holes. So now we can summarize NASA's great observatories. They are the Hubble, which examines visible and infrared wavelengths. The Compton examined gamma wavelengths. The Spitzer examined the infrared. And finally, Chandra tackled the X-ray spectrum. Now, of these four, only the Hubble and Chandra are still operational, but their best before dates are soon approaching.
And so, patient listeners, we finally touch upon the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which primarily employs electromagnetic radiation in the soft X-ray band. It was launched in 1999 aboard the Columbia Space Shuttle during STS-93 and put into an elliptical high Earth orbit, and was initially named the Advanced X-ray Astronomical Facility, but they changed that. An X-ray telescope is the only way astronomers can observe the hot regions of the universe. X-ray telescopes allow us to imagine matter swirling as close as 90 kilometers from the event horizon of a black hole, or to track the expansion of a hot plasma and gas which are produced by a supernova. The mirrors on Chandra are the largest, most precisely shaped and aligned, and smoothest mirrors ever constructed. The largest of these mirrors is about 1.2 meters or 4 feet in width.
Some of the most exciting areas of astronomy deal with the birth and death of stars. These processes create solar systems, fill the universe with heavy elements, and create the supermassive black holes that form the cores of galaxies. And so this is pretty important stuff. The deployment of Chandra was a true exercise in engineering because, as we know, an X-ray of your body has that energy pass through your body and expose a film behind you. X-rays are so small and yet energetic that you don't feel a thing as they pass through you. And it turns out that X-rays pass through most objects the same way. So, if Chandra were designed like a regular optical telescope with a mirror or dish set up to intercept light nearly head-on, it would simply wouldn't work because the X-rays have so much energy that they pass right through the mirror. The trick to Chandra is that if the angle is shallow enough, X-rays will glance off a mirror instead of punching through it, much like sloping armor on a tank allows shells to bounce off rather than penetrate. And a quick search on YouTube about this will offer some very rewarding animations on just how it's done.
And Chandra has made some major discoveries, such as showing how newborn stars play a huge role in determining the fate of planets which might form around them. This research started back in 2003 when astronomers pointed Chandra toward the Orion Nebula, which is full of newly forming stars known as T Tauri.
Okay, Steve, this is a strange name and you probably delved into its origin. Why are they named that?
Well, I tried my best, Tim. and did find that the original variable star was discovered way back in 1852 in the constellation Taurus. Other similar stars now are called T Tauri, but I couldn't find out what that T stands for, although I'm sure that someone out there does. T Tauri stars are young stars that are still forming. Even though they're not fully active yet, they give off powerful bursts of X-rays, and these flares create turbulence in the disk of gas and dust around the star where planets are forming. And while this turbulence might sound chaotic, it can actually help planets settle into more stable orbits, possibly even in the zone where life could exist. These X-ray flares also change the composition of the disk from which the planets form, which tells us that our baby sun probably had a major effect on where we are today and what makes up both us and the planet Earth.
We know that Earth's heaviest elements formed in stars eons ago that died as supernovae and spewed their contents into space. And with Chandra's help, astronomers have been able to learn about a lot of these supernovae processes, which will be the main topic in another episode. But remaining on that topic for a moment, most people know about the constellation Cassiopeia, which forms the big W in the night sky. Chandra's X-ray observations reveal that a single massive star produced thousands of times the number of life essential elements found on Earth. And we're talking of elements such as sulfur, oxygen, and phosphorus. These elements, along with other important ones for life, were spread into space when the star exploded.
Chandra's observations of black holes have revealed that under the right conditions, these stellar remnants may help stars form. And in 2019, scientists found a black hole almost 10 billion light years away in a region of super high star formation. Tim, we're nearing the end of time. That's our second and last pun of the day. But here are some quick and interesting facts about Chandra, which continues to orbit the Earth and provide insights as we speak.
Chandra flies 200 times higher than Hubble, a distance which is more than one-third of the way to the moon.
Chandra can observe X-rays from clouds of gas so vast and so wide that it takes light 5 million years to go from one side to the other.
And during maneuvers from one target to the next, Chandra changes direction more slowly than the movement of a minute hand on a clock.
At 15 meters in length, Chandra was the largest satellite the space shuttle ever launched. And to save weight, the crew number was reduced to 5 astronauts. Further, on that launch day in 1999, it was 30 years to the day that the U.S. landed on the moon. So Neil, Buzz, and Michael were on hand to watch that launch, piloted by the first ever woman commander, Eileen Collins, and she's no relation to Michael.
Chandra's resolving power is equivalent to the ability to read a stop sign at a distance of 20 kilometers, and yet it's the electrical power required of a mere 2 kilowatts, about the same power as a hairdryer.
And Chandra can observe X-rays from particles up to the very last second before they fall into a black hole. And where's the nearest black hole to us? Why, just a mere 1,560 light years away. Talk about resolution power.
Absolutely incredible. So, Steve, not only did we begin to dabble into the abilities of the Chandra X-ray Observatory and the concept of using X-ray wavelengths to explore the mysteries of space and the universe in this last half of our show, we also learned more than a bit about the other great observatories.
And as always, we encourage listeners to do some research into aspects of today's topic which may have piqued their interest, because our weekly research always leads us down intriguing rabbit holes.
I've got one of those for you, Steve. One great one for more information on Chandra. It's on the internet at chandra.harvard.edu, and you won't be disappointed. That's all the time we have today. So until next week, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?